Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and you've probably heard by now that South Dakota's governor signed a bill this week to ban all abortions in his state except to save the life of the mother. It is obviously unconstitutional under Roe, which is the point. We are joined now by Emily Bazelon from Slate.com to count heads on the new Supreme Court and look more closely in general at this overt challenge to Roe versus Wade. Hi, Emily. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks very much.
First, is this a sign of things to come if Roe ever is overturned? Very little has been written that I've seen about how easily this passed the state legislature in South Dakota, and obviously the governor finds it politically feasible or in his interest to sign it. What do you make of that by itself?
Well, I think it's important to remember that the country is divided about abortion in a way that's, you know, regional or state by state. And so, you know, people have done research that shows that were Roe to be overturned, there would be probably somewhere between 20 and 25, maybe a few more states where abortion would remain legal or, you know, legal with some restrictions. And then there are, you know, significant regions of the country where it would be banned or virtually banned. And so I think what we're seeing in South Dakota is an example of a state in which there's a very strong pro-life movement. There's only one abortion clinic in all of South Dakota.
Huh. And do they have to shut down now until this law hits the courts?
I think they're expecting the challenge to be very quick and not to have to shut down, because they're going to be able to get an injunction saying that the law is unconstitutional, at least until the Supreme Court rules otherwise. And because the law was written in a way that, you know, flagrantly is unconstitutional, it shouldn't take long. It's sort of an easy call for the lower courts to make.
Right. But you don't know what's going on at that one abortion clinic in South Dakota, let's say today.
Today, I'm not sure. I know that the day that the law passed, they were spending a lot of time counseling and comforting women. And I assume that they're not having to actually stop what they're doing, because the way, you know, law sort of procedurally is set up, it works so that when you have a law that's unconstitutional, it doesn't go into effect until there's, you know, a mandate from the Supreme Court that changes.
And I've heard there are many states that have already passed contingency bills, abortion bans that kick in if Roe ever disappears. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. Several southern states have rules that have laws like that in place, and perhaps elsewhere in the country as well.
So why this challenge from South Dakota? Why now?
Well, I mean, it's a political calculation. It's a gamble. The gamble is that, you know, there'll be enough of change on the Supreme Court that by the time this bill works itself up to the Supreme Court, it will be the challenger to Roe, and that will be sort of good politics for the people who passed it. And it's certainly possible that that gamble will pay off. We're really talking about the seat of Justice John Paul Stevens, and he is quite an older man. So, you know, it's certainly not inconceivable that this bill will end up being the end of Roe.
When was the last time that Roe was really challenged at the Supreme Court?
Well, a direct challenge to Roe really hasn't gotten any momentum since Planned Parenthood versus Casey in the early 90s. That was very much a serious challenge. I think that the pro-choice movement, given previous opinions that Sandra Day O'Connor had written, expected Roe to be much more threatened than it was. And certainly Justice Harry Blackmun, the author of Roe, was kind of sounding the alarm in a big way about that case. But what we saw with that case was sort of the center of the court holding, and there was this opinion by O'Connor and Justice David Souter and Anthony Kennedy that really sort of held out for the core principles of Roe, even though they also allowed a lot of regulation of abortion. So, you know, since then, the challenges to the kind of core ideas in Roe haven't really gotten any momentum in front of the Supreme Court, but obviously we are looking at a different court now.
We can take a few phone calls for Emily Bazelon from Slate.com. I don't want to turn this into is abortion right or is abortion wrong. We've done that a million times. We'll probably do it a million more times. But this is about the law and this particular challenge to Roe. So if you have questions on the legal status of Roe versus Wade and the South Dakota challenge to it, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So do the head counting a little bit more in detail. You said if one more justice falls, that could be the end of Roe. But I think back in that Casey case in 92 from Pennsylvania, as you say, Roe was affirmed in its basic principle that, you know, abortion had to be considered a woman's right under privacy interpretations of the Constitution, and then they could place restrictions around it, but not too many that were considered, you know, undue obstacles. And so count it down for me.
Count it down. Well, current Supreme Court, we have four justices that I think can be completely and utterly relied on to defend Roe. That is Justice Stevens, Justice Ginsburg, Justice Breyer, and Justice Souter. Then we have Justice Kennedy, who, as we were talking about before, was one of the authors of Planned Parenthood versus Casey and seems to be, you know, somewhat proud of the role he played in that case. So he is also seen as a safe fifth vote to uphold the core of Roe. Then we have Justices Scalia and Thomas, who have made it very clear that they oppose Roe, and we have Roberts and Alito, whose records on the Supreme Court are unclear, but who, based on their past records, seem like they would certainly be up for questioning Roe, although they have rhetorically talked a lot about the value of Supreme Court precedent. So I suppose there's some possibility that they would actually shy away from overturning Roe in full. But these are smart people. And so if they want to find a way to sort of gut Roe without actually overturning it, they will find it.
Bob in Rutherford, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. It's a little bit tangential, but I'm using this as an opportunity to vent a frustration I've had for a large number of years, that it seems to me that the issue has morphed over time from pro-life versus pro-choice into pro-life versus pro-abortion. And as I remember the beginning of the issues back in the 60s, abortion was important because it was seen as the woman's last possible choice if all other options were taken away from her. Instead, it seems like all the pro-choice effort has been focused exclusively on the Roe and abortion issue, and while that's been happening, pro-life has very happily gutted family planning, gutted contraception options, gutted sex education.
So you're frustrated with the pro-choice movement for not being more broad-based in what they've been doing. But is there any legal ramifications? Because I am going to make this conversation stay on point since we only have a few minutes. Emily, is there any legal ramification to that if Bob is right?
I suppose that you could argue that the pro-choice movement could have given ground on some related legal issues, like maybe the partial birth case, and that was sort of misplaced energy, that some of the questions about whether fetuses have legal rights if they're injured in the womb, that puts feminists in a very funny position because they're sort of arguing that these very late-term fetuses don't count in some way. That's, I think, makes a lot of people uncomfortable. I think, though, mostly what your caller is raising are really political questions about sort of the focus of the movement. And though I am sympathetic to some of the points you're making, I think it's important also to remember that, you know, the pro-choice movement gets asked to do a lot of things. And really, it's not a question of their exclusive focus on Roe. It's that they get stretched, and they can't necessarily be in all places at once.
Judy and Chelsea, you're on WNYC. Hi, Judy.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Is there another, I mean, if worse came to worse, if this did come before the Supreme Court and you had to go back to square one, is there another constitutional tack, aside from privacy, that could be taken that might strengthen the pro-choice argument? I've heard Ginsburg, in fact, say that she wished that, I mean, she was a fighter for Roe, and she said, looking back, that she wished that the argument could have been framed differently.
That's a great question, Emily. In the context of this South Dakota challenge, could lawyers argue that the right to an abortion should be upheld under the Constitution, but for different reasons than were so controversially decided by Roe?
They certainly could make that argument, and it is a great question. And you're right, Ginsburg has expressed some discomfort about the rationale in Roe. So,
has she suggested an alternative rationale, Ginsburg?
Well, yes. I mean, I'm not sure if she's. I think so, and certainly. There were other rationales before the court, and they could come back into play, and they, in some ways, are more straightforward. And so the best idea, probably, is to go back to the 14th Amendment and the way in which the court, in large part thanks to Justice Ginsburg, has really made a lot of room for gender equality since Roe was decided. In the early 1970s, we had a 14th Amendment. You know, the 14th Amendment guarantees equal protection under the law and due process for everybody. But it was really written after the Civil War, and it was about defending the rights of African Americans. That was sort of the intent of it. But in the 70s and 80s and even in the 90s, the court started making a lot of room for gender equality. And so there are cases about, you know, women's rights to go to state-run institutions like the Virginia Military Institute. And so there's been a much bigger space carved out for women's rights in the 14th Amendment. And so
you mean so because men can't get pregnant, it could be protected as a 14th Amendment equal protection issue?
Yeah, potentially. You could argue that this is something that's so crucial to women being able to live their lives fully, and that the burden of an unwanted pregnancy only falls on women.
For that rationale,
there's a gender equality argument.
What about a First Amendment religious freedom argument? Because a lot of the debate ultimately over abortion is not whether there's a life there, something is there that's alive, but whether it's a person. You can go into all the religious arguments one way or the other. What about a religious liberty issue, especially for early term abortions?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, we usually think of religion as playing on the other side, and this sort of idea that Catholics and fundamentalist Christians and Jews in particular oppose abortion. But I suppose you could try and make a kind of I think that's going to be tricky, because I don't think that usually people who go to
For example,
making an abortion as an expression of your
we'll finish this thought after a break in a minute. But the most Orthodox Jewish sects would say that abortion is murder. The official position, I believe, of the Reform branch of Judaism, which is the biggest in the United States, is that it isn't murder. And so they could argue that the court, the state, winds up imposing one view of religion over another if it bans abortion. So I'll get your legal analysis of that in a minute when we continue with Emily Bazelon from Slate.com, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Have you ever joined a flash mob? Well, whether you have or have not, the anonymous creator of flash mobs has just come out of the closet in Harper's Magazine, and we're going to talk to him as he reveals his identity in just a couple of minutes. But first, we'll finish up with Emily Bazelon, who covers the Supreme Court for Slate.com. And Emily, you've had a whole 60 seconds now to chew over that religious liberty argument for protecting legal abortion. What do you think?
I'm really glad I had that 60 seconds. So here's what I think. What I think is that if you had a state legislature that passed a law banning abortion, and they talked a lot about God or religious principles in the text of the law, then you might have a pretty good religious freedom argument, because one of the tests for a First Amendment case under the Establishment Clause is whether the government that's passed a law that you're saying violates your religious freedoms, whether that government did it on purpose to kind of take sides among different religions or different sects. And so if legislators started invoking God and seemed to be, or Jesus or whatever, and seemed to be really coming down on one side or the other of a debate that divides churches and divides different denominations.
Right, but it would have to be explicit. They couldn't scratch below the surface like they did in the intelligent design case in Pennsylvania and find out who's really behind this?
Well, I think that would be harder. I mean, this current Supreme Court has held on to this test that doesn't involve too much scratching beneath the surface, to be honest. And so what happened in the Pennsylvania case was that the intelligent design folks were really, it was really easy to show that they were really creationists. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was lots of, they had talked about that a lot. So I guess if you had legislators who went out and started talking about God, even if they didn't put it in the text, mm-hmm. that might be able to carry the day.
Right.
But the problem is that it's trickier because abortion is clearly not only a religious issue. It's also a moral and political issue. And I think that courts would be reluctant to sort of
write it off that
way. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Before you go, what's the timeline here? When is anything going to happen on this? When might it actually get to the Supreme Court?
The timelines I'm reading about are imagining it before the Supreme Court during the 2007-2008 term. I have to say I wonder if it's going to take that long because this law is so clearly unconstitutional. I just don't see why it wouldn't move quickly through the district court and the appeals courts. But, you know, those are questions that are up to judges' calendars, so it's hard to say. But I think it's not inconceivable that it would be on the Supreme Court's docket sometime next year, although perhaps more likely the following year.
We'll see what happens. South Dakota's legislature and governor pushing the limits of Roe versus Wade, actually challenging it directly in the new law that bans all abortions except to save the life of the mother. Emily Bazelon covers the Supreme Court and other legal issues for Slate.com. Emily, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.